Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Good morning. It is Friday morning, the 29th of June. The sun is rising all over our country, and this heat dome is forming over the Midwest. It's going to be about 187 degrees, I understand. And Hartford, don't worry, one of our affiliates there, we'll send it over your direction within about a day or so. And all over in the midst of the sun rising and the heat dome, one thing is true. The tomb is empty. Our Savior is risen. And that is good news indeed, because Jesus has beat death even in the midst of the troubling and difficult headlines of this world. There is always hope and always future. This is Faith Radio Morning. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio by Logan Rausch. And Logan, you know, the first hour, there's a lot of troubling headlines that we had to sort through, and great stuff, great guest to help us think through all of that. So I thought we'd take a break and do something a little lighter that came across the news feed. I know how much you're going to enjoy this. And it says that a 5-foot boa constrictor was found in a rental car at an Oakland airport. It was loose in the car that had been returned. And Logan, I know how much you like snakes and what this would really mean for your life.
5 feet, you said?
5-foot boa constrictor.
That's bigger than most of your children, is it not, Peter?
It really? Well, now I'm scared, Logan. Thank you so much. So, I mean, how are you processing this? Will you ever rent a car again?
I've never rented a car because I'm not 25, so I can't in most states.
You can't, though. It's you driving nuts, Logan. I mean, as articulate and intelligent as you are, and you're 20, you can't, I mean, can you vote at this point?
I can.
Okay, so boa constrictor in the car.
Let me tell you, I can't think of anything but the Shel Silverstein poem, "I'm being swallowed by a boa constrictor." And that poem brings me a lot of pleasant memories, but I think in application, it's probably less so.
You know, and I don't know what it is about snakes. I don't know if it's the Genesis 3 deal that we just sort of have this aversion to the snakes as opposed to maybe even any other form of reptile. I know my son Caleb, who's 18, he came home from his co-op school one day, and his teacher, I believe it was giving away their corn snake, and it was maybe already at this point 2-3 feet long. So we have this pretty large corn snake actually in our home. Hallie and I have nightmares regularly that it's going to get into the HVAC system somehow. If that was to happen, Logan, we would never sleep again. There's something about the slithery nature of snakes, right?
And that's biblical, right? That we're supposed to be afraid of snakes. There's something to go on that.
Well, I think there is. I mean, the Pharisees were a brood of vipers. I mean, there's nothing pleasant about this headline. There was another one that outside of a Walmart, there was an 8-foot-long alligator that was captured. Can you imagine coming out with, you know, your 24-pack of toilet paper, your LaCroix mineral water in this cart, and all of a sudden there's an alligator there to greet you?
One of the greatest tragedies of this world is losing our good friend Steve Irwin. He needs to be around to tackle these alligators, not only for our safety, but for our entertainment.
That's a great point, Logan. Well, it's about 7 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break, and we're going to be joined by a new friend of the show, Gary Stratton, who is a dean at Johnson University. And Gary spent a significant portion of the last 10 years or so in Hollywood and helping Christian scriptwriters and films. So we're going to talk theology and film and how to tell good stories and what that means for our Christian faith. It is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner. Stay with us. It is 9 minutes past the hour, and Logan came up with some walk-up music for a new friend guest of the show. We are talking with Gary Stratton, who is a university professor at Johnson University, Worldview Spiritual Formation. And Gary's been gracious enough to join us on the line. Good morning, Gary.
Morning, Peter.
So, you know, we've been friends for a while, and I have to say, I'm still a little bit bitter about, you know, how you just sort of left me in the lurch maybe, I don't know, what was it, 10 years ago or whatever it was, that you and your wife Sue packed up the stagecoach and you went all Beverly Hillbillies on this thing and headed out to Hollywood to do some work out with Christian scriptwriters. Is that right, Gary?
Yes, that's true. So, I was teaching at Bethel University. My wonderful daughter, who is called to be a screenwriter in Hollywood, went through the top, certainly at that time, and I think still today, the top program for helping Christians enter mainstream media. And the last day of the program, she called and said, "Dad, we just had this banquet. They're praying. They need an executive director." And I said, oh, that's great. I'll pray for that. And she said, no, no, Dad, you are their executive director. And I laughed, and I told my wife, and Sue laughed, which kind of hurt. But because I love my daughter, I spent a beautiful Sunday afternoon in Minnesota. And only people in Minnesota know that, and it was August. So, you know, you only get four August afternoons, and two of them are thunderstorms. I mean, you just count on it. And so I was angry as could be when I got done. But I did it, filled it out, and sure enough, a bunch of Hollywood professionals who put this program together said, oh, we desperately need an educator. So when my CV hit the desk, they were on the phone with me immediately. The next thing you know, we were loading up the truck and moving to Beverly Hills.
Amazing. So how many years did you spend in Hollywood, and what did you do specifically there, Gary?
Well, we were there for 7 years, and I have to tell people I'm not a writer, a director, a producer. Don't send me your screenplay to try to get it produced. I'm not a director. I'm an educator. I'm a spiritual formation professional. I mean, really what we're trying to do is train people who are called in to be missionaries to the world of Hollywood, how to learn from the very best Christians in Hollywood and mainstream Hollywood, how to write compelling stories and direct and produce films, to be content creators, and then to help them survive the difficult challenges. It might be the most difficult mission field in the world. So we directed two nonprofits and helped plant a church and did kind of everything you can do in that kind of context.
And Logan was talking to staff the air during break too about sometimes the quality of our Christian films. Logan, what were you mentioning there?
I don't want to speak too poorly about them, but they're kind of, some films can be a bit of a laughing matter in terms of the general secular community. I mean, very few secular people want to actively go to something like God's Not Dead. They aren't interested in that. You know, if it's clearly speaking to a Christian audience, then it's hard to get other people in the door. And I love what I've been hearing from people like Phil Cook out of Hollywood, who says, you know, there's better ways to draw people in with a Christian message of a film is to put those themes in there and make something that's inherently just a good movie. And then tell them afterwards when they say, oh, I thought this was a really good scene, say, well, you know what that's inspired by?
Yeah, I mean, Gary, what did you find out there? It's, you know, Christian filmmaking isn't always maybe as top-notch as some other. How did you kind of help navigate some of that in Hollywood?
Boy, that is a great question. And, you know, one of the barriers, I think, to helping me go, one of the things God used to call was to see that the tide was turning. That it's actually, one Sunday afternoon, my wife and I were at church in Chaska, and somebody said that they had gone and seen a movie that was really good. And so we went to see it that afternoon as a family, and I realized 15 minutes to it, I had this like, oh, no, it's a Christian movie, and which I knew would be terrible plot development and horrible character structure, and people didn't know what they were doing. But instead, it was really good. I mean, I was overwhelmed by how good it was. Now, it was not great, but I realized whoever made this film could make a great film. I did not know that the writer of that program had graduated from Act One, the program that I later would go to direct, and I didn't know that the producer of it, John Anderson, was on the board at Act One. All I knew is that when I came out, I was so encouraged that here were Christians who were capable of telling great stories, and I think one day they could do something great. And I think we're starting to see the tide turn. Now, my work primarily was with Christians who were trying to enter mainstream media. They weren't actually trying to go into quote-unquote Christian film. Matter of fact, the Christian film market didn't really exist yet at that point. Now, since then, that's all become really blurred. We've got Phil Cook, you mentioned, just wonderful people who are doing a great job of doing really excellent work, whether they're working with a church or working with a film production company. They're doing world-class work, and it makes such a difference. We have Christians writing on probably 25 or 30 different television shows right now, and just amazingly, you see their work start to pop out in the most remarkable ways.
And Gary, this is more than just entertainment. I mean, some people might suggest, oh gosh, what a waste of time for Christians to be writing film, and really, does this matter at the end of the day? But you teach a class called Theology of Film, and in that, you explore the importance of story for how it impacts us as people. Just talk us through what you found, some of the research, and how important is story in our journey of life?
Well, you know, the really amazing thing is that the more we study the human brain, the more we realize that God's hardwired into us. Storytelling is just the thing that brains do. That we, one of the primary functions of our brain is that of all the things that happen to us in a given day, to put them together into a cohesive thematic interpretation of our experiences. If I asked you, Paul, did you have a good day yesterday?
And then the response is, right, you end up thinking, gosh, what details am I thinking about right now?
Right. But you normally just pick one or two things. Oh, it was a good day because I got to sleep in and nobody hassled me in my job. I mean, just, well, 10,000 things happened to you that day. You just happened to pick the two that created a thematic story. And the way that we store information, the way we express things are through stories. And I think God has hardwired that into our brain. And that what we're discovering is that that we are transformed by stories in a way that we're not transformed by anything else. That we have this capacity known as brain mirroring, that whatever somebody else, when we look at somebody doing something, we have a capacity to start doing the same thing. It's kind of like in high school youth group camp where you try to have a smile battle, where somebody try to get the other person to smile. And it's just, it's compelling when somebody else is smiling, smile. Matter of fact, what Hollywood is looking for is that star that when they smile, the entire audience smiles, they can't help but do it. And that's what happens when we're watching a movie. I mean, a couple of, kids are sitting there watching Darth Vader fighting Luke Skywalker in a lightsaber battle, and it makes perfect sense that Luke Skywalker is thinking about lightsabers, but suddenly all those young kids watching it are also thinking about lightsabers. And what do they do when the movie's over? They go out and start having a lightsaber battle. And it seems really silly, and yet that's the way that story works, that we literally bond with the heroes of the stories that we're watching and that we're listening to. We secrete oxytocin in the same way we do when a mother's with their child, or when you pet your dog, you're flooded with oxytocin, your dog is flooded with oxytocin. Interestingly, when you pet your cat, you're flooded with oxytocin, your cat is not flooded with oxytocin. That explains a lot. But we're watching a film. Paul Zak has done all this research now that when we're watching a film and the film is done well and the story's a character-driven story where we bonded with the character, we literally start secreting oxytocin and we start caring about that character as if they were a human being that we know. And then we, in ways that aren't even known to us, we can measure 5 days later how that character is still influencing our brain and our actions.
Hmm. It's Gary Stratton, professor at Johnson University. It does a lot of work with theology and film. And Gary, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I would love to talk a bit about the importance of story in our Christian faith as well. But I have to say, your description of what kids can do and after a movie, when we roll through an episode of Kung Fu Panda in our house, Hallie and I literally leave for date night and just let the kids have at it. So 17 minutes past the hour, we'll take a short break here on Faith Radio Mornings. We'll be back in just a minute with more from Gary Stratton. It's 20 minutes past the top of the hour. This is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner. Logan, I love that you found the Tarzan Jungle music to introduce Gary Stratton into the show. Great start, Gary, just talking about film. And Logan and I were actually acting out a little Kung Fu Panda here during the break, too. And I found that a 22-year-old who's a bit younger than me, that it's not a real good proposition for me.
You know, Peter, you put up a pretty good fight. But I got to say, I've seen all three of those movies like 60 times. So
yeah, I know. You clearly knew some of those movies. I did not. And Gary, before the break, yeah, obviously we're talking about the importance of story. And I mean, let's bring this into our Christian story, because at the end of the day, the Christian faith really is about being swept up in the redemptive story of God that God has been up to since the beginning. When sin came into this world, God has been moving redemptively in an active, ongoing way. So Christianity is not necessarily reduced down to a series of principles, right? I mean, this really is a story that we're called to live within.
Yeah, that is the most foundational and important thing, I think, when people think about a worldview, that the foundation of everyone's worldview is the story that they're living at a given moment, the stories that they've gotten from their faith community, from their schools, from their society, and the story that they're living in their own life experience. And without that, we can't make a big difference in the world, because the Christian's faith is not so much about following certain rules or conforming to certain roles. It's about living out this profound story of how God is in the business of redeeming the world and bringing it back into his eternal purposes for us, and for us to truly experience the love of God. And that kind of compelling story is the kind of thing that enables us to make sacrifices, to live, to have moral courage, to do something that's not in our benefit, but is only for the benefit of the others. And those times when Christians and churches are totally focused on keeping the rules and following the roles and defending the faith, as opposed to living out this bigger story, it's very difficult for the Holy Spirit to compel us to do something beyond a very defensive faith.
And, you know, for those, and I think many of us struggle with sort of the sense of purposelessness, right? And maybe we find our purpose temporarily in a vocation or in a relationship, and we're always sort of looking earthward for purpose in our lives to kind of find that sense of well-being. But what an invitation to purpose to participate in the larger story that's always been going on. I mean, whether you're 1 year old or 100 years old, there is this participation in the story, and we find our purpose in that place.
Right. And our story, the story we're living in any given moment, determines kind of the plausibility structures for what's open to us and what isn't. So, you know, I always tell my students, they walk into the classroom, how many of you, you know, went to the wall and started stretching? And they all say, nobody, this is stupid. This is an academic class. Well, what if it was a class? It was a kung fu class. Well, everyone would have been doing that. But it's only because it would have been plausible, the story they were living at that moment. Out of the 10,000 things you could be doing at any moment, you only consider a couple of them because of the story you're living in. And so to fill our lives with stories that compel us to live heroically according to the principles that God's laid out and could be like the great heroes of the faith, without that, we just go right along with the flow of culture and just become like everybody else around us with a little Christian part of our life on the side.
And for young parents, Gary, I mean, what would you suggest in terms of as we begin to introduce them to the faith and remind them of the hand from which they've come, that being God in this journey of life? I mean, how important is it to tell the children the stories of the biblical text and even maybe possibly act some of them out?
Well, I think it's crucial. I mean, whoever tells the best stories exerts the most powerful influence on the worldview of any culture or in any family. And your family has to have a story that your kids see that you're living out of. And that's easy in the one sense. 50% of the Old Testament is story, at least 60% of the New Testament story, 80% of Jesus' public teaching was story, was parables. So to get that story thing going in your family is crucial. I do think that's one great thing where what we call Christian films, films that are written purely for a Christian audience, I think those are great things to use with young children. And there's, of course, there's some outstanding films like Prince of Egypt or different things that are telling the biblical stories in ways that are very compelling for young people. But just reading the stories, getting them caught up, acting them out. We had a little puppet that we called Moses Moose, and Moses Moose would come out and tell the biblical stories, and my kids still make fun of it, but they remember the stories that Moses Moose told them about the heroes of the faith.
So wait, you came out with a moose in the form of Moses, or Moses in the form of a moose? Like, how did you sew this thing together, Gary?
Well, I don't know. We just had this moose puppet, and we just turned it into Moses Moose, and he would come out and tell the biblical stories in this kind of voice, and I'm a compulsive storyteller anyway. And it was just a great way for the children to interact with ways that where they could use their imagination. And that's the key. It's capture the imagination in a way that only good story can.
Now, if you can find a picture of this moose, Gary, at some point, I'm putting it right up on the Faith Radio page for this morning show. Logan?
I tell you what, I would love to meet Moses Moose. That sounds like a party.
It really does. So we have just about a minute or so left, Gary. What do you see kind of trajectory moving forward within Hollywood and film? I mean, there are more and more Christian movies coming out, anything from obviously the Noah story a few years ago to recently the Apostle Paul. What's some of the trends within Hollywood for some of these movies?
Well, I watch Christians who are trying to make movies, you know, principally for Christian audiences, getting better and better and better at what they're doing. I'm incredibly encouraged by that. And I see Christians who are called kind of to go into the belly of the beast of mainstream Hollywood, moving deeper and deeper and deeper into influencing films. We have at least one production company that has tremendous Christian influence in it right now, and you can just see it coming out of what they're doing. You see it in the writing. A television show I could recommend right now, and I've only seen 4 episodes, but so far, just the ways that Christians have woven things into the new drama, Condor, is just fascinating to watch.
Really? Condor? Is it streaming on Netflix, or where is the show viewable?
It's funny. I don't remember what the network is right now, but if you do a search on your on-demand, you'll find it.
Got it.
And now it's the Three Doors of a Condor story told every, so it's not for kids. But it's a very compelling look at trust and faith. And there's got some neat faith components to it.
That's great. It's Gary Stratton from Johnson University. He is university professor at Worldview Spiritual Formation, spent a lot of years in Hollywood and keeps his finger on the pulse of what's happening within culture and film and theology. Gary, I'd love to have you back on the show again. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter. God bless you.
Me too. It's 3 minutes. Take a 3 minute break for Breakpoint and some news, and we'll come back for the last part of our show, in which we'll be joined by author Paul Kengor and talk about some of the new books he is writing, as well as what he's covered relative to some of the historical figures in our country. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You know, Paul, we've been talking about this heat dome that is emerging over the Midwest, but and I've been suggesting that we're going to send it Hartford's direction, but apparently Hartford already has it.
Oh, yeah. I do the weather for Hartford every morning, and yeah, they're looking at today, right on through at least Independence Day, they're going to be well into the 90s. So they're kind of probably, sorry guys, we got that wrong. But hey, if you really want heat though, go to Denver. Yesterday, tied a record high of 105.
Oh, I'm heading up to Duluth. We're going to get that wind chill off Lake Superior, and we're going to enjoy the day. Let's take a break for news. We'll come back, and we'll be joined by Paul Kengor here to talk about politics and some of the books that he's been writing. Stay with us. Author and president of Cornerstone University, Joe Stoll, is speaking to us this morning about servant leadership.
Shepherd leadership. That's a great metaphor if you understand what a shepherd is. And I think when we think of servant leadership, it's such a worn-out phrase. You know, everybody yawn or servant leadership, but it is so key. It is right at the heart of the matter. In fact, I think that if you're really running your enterprise as a leader biblically and in a kingdom way, then organizational charts are upside down. Organizational charts are this pyramid, right? I get to be on the top. Yay for me. You know, everybody applaud for me. I have the power. But if we're listening to what Christ said, but it shall not be so among you, you got to flip that. And I'm at the bottom. The pinnacle of the pyramid is at the bottom. And I am serving every level above me. And actually, it's the people at that long top level that are really carrying out the mission. And that's one of many ways in which we need to think about leadership if we're going to have truly long-term results of effective leadership in building the houses that God's called us to build.
If you want to catch that entire segment, head to myfaithradio.com. Joe Stoll talks extensively about leadership, real helpful subject. We take a short break, and we come back with Paul Kengor. We're going to talk about the legacy of Anthony Kennedy and the impact some of his decisions have made rippling out in our country over all these years. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Faith Radio Mornings.
Let me ask you a question. How did you learn to forgive? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. It's not something most of us think about, but I'd wager that you weren't taught to forgive. You just caught it from your parents. You learn by their actions what it meant to forgive and forget. The sad part is, if they held grudges, you most likely do too. Forgiveness isn't easy. And when you're hurt by someone, especially your children, it's tempting to hold back love. The problem here is that you're teaching your kids two things. First, they're only lovable when they don't mess up. And second, that they'll treat their own kids like that. So break the cycle. Trust God and offer forgiveness.
There's much more encouragement for parents from Mark Gregston online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
It is just about 20 minutes before the top of the hour. You're listening to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we are joined at this time on the line by friend of the show and author Paul Kengor. He is a professor of political science at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. Written over a dozen books, including A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, The Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century, and one I'm particularly interested in here, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, Peter. It's good to meet you.
Yeah, great to be on the air with you. I'm curious, you know, we're just kind of having a conversation in our family the other day with our teenagers, trying to figure out the difference between communism and socialism exactly. Do you have a sense of what some of the main differences are between these two systems?
Well, now that's a subject I could go on about for a while, but I'll try to give you the cliff notes, right?
Love it. Yep.
So and in fact, let me add here that just up in New York, as I think a lot of people saw in the last couple of days, a literal member of the Democratic Socialists of America just won a Democratic primary contest, and that's getting a lot of news right now. And also in my area in Western Pennsylvania, two Democratic Socialists of America members
defeated two longtime traditional Democrats. So they're really thriving. And in fact, the DSA, which claims to be the largest socialist group in America, now says that they have about 40,000 members in the U.S.
Wow.
And to give you a sense, only a nerd like me would follow this stuff this closely, right? But this is what I do. but Communist Party USA, their leader, John Bachtel, says that they have about 5,000 members.
Hmm.
And he's saying that they've had a surge under Donald Trump. So must not be much of a surge, right, Peter?
Right.
Right, 4,800 maybe to 5,000 or something. I don't know. But so the Democratic Socialists of America have upwards of maybe 8 to 10 times the number of people that Communist Party USA has. And they would claim that they're not as far to the left as the communists. So if you were laying out the political spectrum, right, the communists would take all of your property. Socialists would take some of it. But they both talk about common ownership of the means of production. So turning a lot of things that the private sector does over to government. But in strict Marxist theory, socialism is a transitory kind of way station on the way to full communism. And a lot of communists use the words communist and socialist interchangeably. In fact, USSR, the second S in USSR stood for socialist after Soviet. And even Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin, the Bolsheviks were sprung out of the Social Democratic Party of Russia. So they had considered themselves social democrats before they all met and they split into the majority of the Bolsheviks and the minority of the Mensheviks. So in some sense, there's not a lot of difference between them. And if you run into a socialist, you might say, hey, explain to me what in your mind is the difference between a socialist and a communist, and what's a democratic socialist and what's a social democrat. And you may be surprised by the answer you get. And if you get 10 socialists in a room together and you ask them each for a definition, you're probably going to get 10 different definitions. So, I hope that's not too convoluted, but that's kind of where the situation is today.
Well, I love it. And you referenced the headlines that obviously are coming out, and socialism is growing among the millennial generation. Logan and I talk about that quite a bit. And so I think we do need to educate ourselves. And these things can happen in a country. I mean, the USSR was not always socialist. These revolutions can take shape. And it's just interesting. It's going to be really interesting for the 2018 midterms coming up. So I would love – there is something that you've been writing about, a headline that came out this week, a pretty sort of cataclysmic moment for the Supreme Court for this year. These vacancies don't come up very often, and Anthony Kennedy retired. And you wrote an article reflecting on Kennedy's legacy, and even that maybe it was one of Reagan's most difficult or worst moments, just given the impact Kennedy has had over all this time on the court. Kind of walk us through what you see there.
Well, that's right, Peter. And yeah, that piece, for people, if they're interested, check it out. It's at American Spectator. And I really do think it was Ronald Reagan's worst mistake. And I've written, I'd have to think about it, I think 6 or 7 books on Ronald Reagan. And so when I say that he was Reagan's worst mistake, I come at that with some credibility, knowing Reagan's background very, very well. And in fact, Reagan had 3 U.S. Supreme Court picks. Now, the middle one, Antonin Scalia, was wonderful. The first one, Sandra Day O'Connor, 1981, and then Kennedy was the last one in 1988. And a lot of people forget this, but Anthony Kennedy got the seat that was originally supposed to go to Judge Robert Bork. And Bork was absolutely smeared and tarred and feathered, viciously attacked as anti-woman by the likes of Ted Kennedy and Joe Biden on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And all that Robert Bork had done at that point, I mean, he wasn't part of a Me Too movement or anything like that. Robert Bork was simply arguing that Roe v. Wade was bad constitutional law, which it was. It's constitutionally an abomination. If you get liberal law school professors kind of alone in a room and talk to them about this, they laugh at how ridiculous Roe v. Wade is. I mean, it's horrible constitutional law. But Bork was arguing that it should have been sent back to the states. The abortion issues should have been sent back to the states. So for that, he was savaged at the time. And we ended up with Anthony Kennedy. And Kennedy, in June 1992, along with Sandra Day O'Connor, this was a 6-3 vote. He voted with Planned Parenthood in the infamous case Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which enshrined Roe versus Wade as the law of the land. And now 26 years and counting, that's continued to give us Roe v. Wade for another 26 years. And in fact, in some ways, Peter, a lot of people believe that Planned Parenthood v. Casey is even a worse case for pro-lifers than Roe v. Wade was, especially if you look at Kennedy's thinking. And it wasn't supposed to be that way. Kennedy, Reagan thought, was a conservative, a moderate, a so-called strict constructionist when it came to court issues. And he thought as well that he was pro-life, that he was a kind of an old-school pro-life Irish Catholic. But he got there, and I know people who knew Kennedy very well, including Reagan's closest advisor, Bill Clark, who used to have lunch with Kennedy once a week in Sacramento in California in the late 70s, early 80s. And they thought that what they were going to get in Anthony Kennedy was absolutely not what they got. Now, Kennedy's made a lot of good decisions, too. But on that one, Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and also in 2015, it was Kennedy who led the majority opinion redefining marriage in America to allow for marriage beyond the idea of one man and one woman. So Kennedy on these hot-button cultural issues, cultural moral issues, has been a real disaster.
Mm. Talking with Paul Kengor, professor of political science, and Paul, regular contributor to the show, helping us walk through what we can expect also with the upcoming vacancy and the conversation. I want to get into that with you after the break, Paul. Thanks for the great conversation and just understanding how much of an impact these justices can have on our daily lives here as a country. It's Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we'll be back in just a minute. It's 10 minutes before the top of the hour, and we have joining us on the line Paul Kengor, a professor of political science at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. And Paul, obviously, we're talking extensively about the legacy of Anthony Kennedy before the break. I'd be curious, what can we expect moving forward? I think there's this sense when his vacancy was announced that immediately we would have a new justice, and we're talking about Roe versus Wade being overturned by January of 2019. But that's not how this whole process works, right?
No, that's right. I mean, it's a long, slow process and all of this and all of these things. I do expect that President Trump will probably put somebody forward pretty soon. I mean, he works quick on these things. He has a list of anywhere from 10 to 25 different justices that he could choose from. It's a list that was provided to him primarily by the Federalist Society. It's a very, very good list, very, very qualified people. And I think he'll probably pick somebody from that list. I mean, that was a campaign promise that he made that he certainly honored with Neil Gorsuch. Regardless of that, and it doesn't matter who's on that list, I think you're going to see, Peter, a party line vote. You know, the idea that the last time around every single Democrat voted against Neil Gorsuch, and the way that they attacked Neil Gorsuch, I think was really awful. I think it did a great disservice and discredit to them. I understand their anger and that it was almost a protest vote in the Republicans not approving Merrick Garland. I understand that. But still, to go on record to vote against somebody with Neil Gorsuch arguably might have the best credentials, certainly from an academic standpoint, coming in of almost any Supreme Court justice in history, and I think it made them look like there's nobody that they would support that President Trump puts forward. So I thought that was a bad move, but this next person, who's definitely going to be replacing, you know, the top swing vote, Anthony Kennedy in the Supreme Court, this is going to be a knockdown dragout. So I pity whoever this person is. I mean, he or she is going to have his life, her life, turned upside down. This person is going to get borked, right, to use the verb that became Robert Bork's name, borrowed from Robert Bork's name, is going to get borked all over again. It's going to be ugly.
Yeah, and I love that you're bringing up the perspective of history, because with Justice Gorsuch, obviously the Republicans had invoked a nuclear option, so-called, to eliminate the 60-person vote in the filibuster, and there's all sorts of angst around that decision. But we're still living in these conversations coming up, we're still living in the rippling effects of what happened with Justice Bork all those years ago.
Well, that's right, and you know, just to show people that I'm not being partisan about this, Democrats in the Senate versus Republicans in the Senate, Democrats really are uniquely bad about this. And let me give you an example: Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Stephen Breyer, who are the two hardest core liberals on the court, got almost unanimous approval by Republicans in the Senate when they were put forward by liberal presidents. And Rick Santorum, who was my Pennsylvania senator at the time, I remember him standing at what we call the Rock at Grove City College on one of our quads, and him being grilled by some of our students saying, "How could you, as a conservative, strict constructionist, how could you just have voted for people like Stephen Breyer and Ruth Bader Ginsburg? You and all these conservative Republican senators." And Santorum gave the standard answer of conservative Republican senators, which is, "We believe that constitutionally a president should have the pick of who they want for the Supreme Court, and it's our job as a Senate not to put them through a political, ideological litmus test, but to evaluate whether or not they're judicially qualified, whether they're of fitness of mind, whether they have a normal judicial temperament, and if they do, to give the president the person that the president wants." And so they've done that. But the Democrats, on the other hand, they don't do that. Neil Gorsuch was certainly of judicial fitness and qualification. If the person doesn't meet their standards on Roe v. Wade, and next it will be Obergefell, that'll be the new litmus test, then they vote against him. They're very bad about this. They're very, very political about it. And so I think what you'll find here will be probably close to a 50-50 situation, where you could well have Vice President Mike Pence, in one of the few practical duties that the vice president has, possibly sitting there in the Senate chamber ready to cast the tie-breaking vote on another party line vote for the next Supreme Court justice.
That's Paul Kangori, who's professor of political science, helping us understand some of the upcoming confirmation hearings that we're likely to see in the news. Paul, we got to run, but before we go, Logan is suggesting that there's no age requirements for a Supreme Court justice, so he kind of wants to cast his name in there. Can you help him, Paul, sort of scrub up his bona fides so maybe he could be considered, Logan?
I mean, feel like there might be a requirement for a law degree of some sort, but I can buy that online like I could a ministering thing, couldn't I?
Well, here's a funny piece of history for you. We've had Supreme Court justices that and people who have been nominated in recent years. Bill Clark was potentially almost one of them, who haven't had law degrees, if you could believe that or not. But earlier on, a lot of Supreme Court justices simply took the bar, did what they did to get legal training. They were appointed to the bench. And the late Antonin Scalia had a beautiful dissent a few terms ago, in which he said, "Look at the kind of the arrogance and the judicial conceit that we see nowadays, where the current Supreme Court makeup looks nothing like America. It's all like Harvard and Yale.
Yeah.
It's all from the Northeast." And so, no, Logan, I think it'd be good to get somebody in there. You kind of shake up the demographics a little bit on the high court.
It's great stuff, Paul. Thanks so much. We got to run, take a short break, and wrap up the show. Logan, I wish you all the best on this air conditioner install here today as you're dealing with a heat dome over the Midwest and into Hartford. What's going to happen here today?
It's going to be really hot. I'm going to figure out how to use a drill and how to put something in a window.
Thanks for listening to Faith Radio Mornings. Remember, the tomb is empty. He has risen. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll catch you on Monday.
A
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.